Welcome to the deep end of public education. My name is Kristen Grubbs, and I'm happy you decided to join me for the second episode in my series about the book Belonging Through a Culture of Dignity by Floyd Cobb and John Crownapple. I hope you'll forgive me for the long delay since the last episode. My days have been full as I've been working on a big project over the last couple of months. I'll share more about that at the end of this episode, but for now, let's dive back in to the deep end of public education. In my last episode, I introduced you to the book Belonging Through a Culture of Dignity, The Keys to Successful Equity Implementation, and how Cobb and Crownapple say that equity measures are not leading to meaningful change. Moving on in our study of this book, in Chapter 4, the authors say belonging is a sense of where one feels appreciated, validated, accepted, and treated fairly within an environment. Access is the ability to have opportunities equal to those of other people. These authors disagree with ability grouping, claiming it likely provides inequitable access to curriculum and marginalizes students in groupings perceived as less able. What do they suppose we do with students who are struggling and need a little extra one-on-one time to progress in their education? What about the students who are bored because they're ahead of the class and aren't being challenged enough? Are these authors suggesting that students should all remain in the same class together despite their individual needs? Cobb and Crownapple say, because of perceptions of who you are, identity, either you're embraced, included, left out, excluded, or forced to negotiate what matters most to you, either belonging or access. If access is more important, you endure discomfort and assaults on your identity until you can reap the perceived benefits of integration. If belonging is more important, you'll abandon the notion of integration and seek the belonging and safety offered in a segregated environment. These authors defined in the first few chapters of their book two different types of diversity, cognitive diversity and identity diversity. However, as they discuss diversity throughout the rest of the book, it is always in reference to identity diversity. This diversity, the book says, focuses on the often visible markers of difference like race, gender, sexual identity, physical ability, and religion, to name a few. Listen to what they have to say about the dynamics within social settings. Quote, those in power create the standards that determine belonging in order to create a select group possessing a specific shared attribute, like intellect, intrinsic quality, skill, interest, wealth, strength, or ancestry. This ends up inflating the value of that attribute. As a result, those excluded can regard these criteria as arbitrary, unfair, fictitious, illegitimate, or unstable. The included elite enjoy membership and privileges that are denied to the excluded. But the inside elite must also adhere to the established norms or risk being excommunicated and losing the benefits of membership, end quote. Honestly, this sounds pretty accurate. Think back over the last couple years. Have there been times when you were deemed included or excluded based on a single inflated attribute? Were you discriminated against because of this attribute? Think outside the box. What if we weren't talking about race? Do you wear a face covering of some sort? Do you wear a symbol or a label of some sort on your name tag or lanyard to denote something special about you? Has that denotation triggered a positive or negative response from others? Let's see what Cobb and Crownapple are referring to when they talk about inflated attributes. In a section of Chapter 4 called Race as Criteria, they say, perhaps the concept of race, being white more specifically, is the most prominent example of social exclusion and belonging in U.S. history. Bear with me, as I'd like to read a few excerpts straight from Belonging Through a Culture of Dignity so you can best understand the author's point of view. Speaking about immigrants new to America, here's what Cobb and Crownapple have to say. Race ultimately diminished ethnic differences between those deemed white. In fact, the concept of whiteness only existed in proximity to blackness. People were either in or out, us or them, to become white, European immigrants purged ethnic markers of belonging, names, accents, traditions, etc., in order to melt and meet the conditions of this new formed racial identity. Once admitted, they had greater access. If they also happened to be male and owned property, they could have full access to the benefits of society. The criteria for who could identify as white have changed and shifted over time. Definitions of whiteness were never stable. Before one drop of African blood became a widely accepted standard for social exclusion, different states created different definitions of what constituted whiteness. A person could legally change races simply by crossing state lines. In fact, whiteness, as Joe Feagan argues, is more definitively characterized as the absolute right to exclude and ultimately the entitlement to determine who belongs. This entitlement has plagued social equality throughout U.S. history. Entitlement has determined, among other things, where groups of people can live or work, whether or not they can have basic rights, like voting and health care, and what type of social activities and relationships they can have with whom, like marriage. To this day, the markers of race often determine the extent to which people feel they belong in any given environment. First off, my concern with these passages, as well as others in previous chapters, is the use of race-centered language. This book claims to be offering a new way to approach equity efforts in educational settings, but what they're doing is reintroducing segregation as practiced in the past. Their language is divisive. The only times it uses the words black or blackness, it's in a neutral manner. Yet when they use the words white or whiteness, it is in a stereotype or accusatory way. How is this use of language new and inclusive? In a sense, they're right to a degree when they say immigrants would drop cultural traits from their prior home to be able to fit into their new country. However, they're assuming that's because they were scared to stand out. I'm sure that's the case for many, but for some, dropping cultural traditions of the past may have been a choice to disconnect from their prior country where oppression truly denied them happiness. Here's an observation I've made in recent years that may not be popular, but it is true. The real definition of the word oppression has been watered down to the point that I don't think the average American using the word nowadays actually understands what it is. I'm a fan of looking to the dictionary when I'm questioning how a word is being used. I always double-check its meaning, no matter how familiar I am with it or how often I've used it in my life. I still like referring to the dictionary or multiple dictionaries. Dictionary.com defines oppression as the exercise of authority or power in a burdensome, cruel, or unjust manner. Merriam-Webster defines it as unjust or cruel exercise of authority or power. Cambridge Dictionary defines it as a situation in which people are governed in an unfair and cruel way and prevented from having opportunities and freedom. Public education has changed quite a bit over the last few years. Would you say that public education in the U.S. prior to 2020 was oppressive? Did our schools exercise authority in unjust, burdensome, or cruel ways? Did our schools prevent people from having opportunities and freedom in education? Do you think our current public education in the U.S. is oppressive? Do our schools prevent students from having opportunities? Do you think our schools are stifling freedom? If we step back and look at the bigger picture, our country is called the land of opportunity for a reason. We have put into place laws that outline the rights of all people to have opportunity, no matter their background. Yes, some places may present more challenges for success, but that doesn't mean that opportunity isn't there. What I mean by this is, for example, if a person wants to be an actor, but they're from a small town in, say, Iowa, they're going to have to work differently toward their goal of acting than someone who lives in the heart of Hollywood or LA. Their challenges will be different, and their approach will have to be different, but that doesn't mean they cannot be successful in reaching their goal. We know there are some public schools that are funded well and have access to all sorts of learning tools, while there are others that are doing well just to keep the lights on. That definitely poses challenges for students in the schools with less funding, but that doesn't mean opportunity isn't there. Yes, funding can be an issue. Yes, access can be hindered depending on funding, and it needs addressed. However, we cannot assume oppression is the cause of the disparities. Cobb and Crownapple say that desegregation efforts that followed Brown v. Board of Education decimated Black communities. Their language is harsh and true to a degree, as desegregation left many Black teachers out of work as they couldn't compete with their white counterparts, as their own educations were limited by segregation. Similarly, the sense of community found in segregated schools was easy to come by since students attended school with the same people with which they lived and played. Despite the benefits of inclusivity and community, segregated schools denied access to educational tools that some students needed for success. Integrating schools was no easy task. But if we were to weigh the benefits and risks of desegregation, I believe we'd find time and time again that it was a necessary path. In the opinion that followed the famous Supreme Court decision in 1954, Justice Earl Warren wrote, "To separate children from others of similar age and qualifications solely because of their race generates a feeling of inferiority as to their status in the community that may affect their hearts and minds in ways unlikely ever to be undone." Belonging through a culture of dignity says that integration is often a dehumanizing experience where students find it difficult to be themselves. The authors go on to define inclusion as engagement within a community where the equal worth and inherent dignity of each person is honored. An inclusive community promotes and sustains a sense of belonging. It affirms the talents, beliefs, backgrounds, and ways of living of its members. Tread with me here in this definition as we explore what it's really saying. Engagement with a community where the equal worth and inherent dignity of each person is honored. Yes, an inclusive community that promotes and sustains a sense of belonging. Okay. It affirms the talents, beliefs, backgrounds, and ways of living of its members. Wait, what? Let's check back with the dictionary for this word, affirm. Dictionary.com says to affirm means to state or assert positively, maintain as true, confirm or ratify, to express agreement with or commitment to, support by giving approval, recognition, or encouragement. Merriam-Webster says to affirm is to validate or confirm, to state positively, to assert as valid or confirmed, to show or express a strong belief in or dedication to. Cambridge Dictionary says to affirm is to state something as true, to publicly show your support for an opinion or idea. This book my school district chose to use for professional development is teaching that to be an inclusive educational environment, teachers must affirm students' beliefs, talents, backgrounds, and ways of living. What does that look like? Let's insert these definitions of affirmation into Cobb and Crownapple's definition of inclusion. Teachers must validate and confirm a student's religion. Teachers must recognize or encourage a student's way of living. Teachers must maintain as true a student's beliefs. Teachers must publicly show support for their students' opinions or ideas. How does this definition of inclusion, as presented by Cobb and Crownapple, apply to teachers and other school staff and administrators? Wouldn't they also require affirmation of their talents, beliefs, backgrounds, and ways of living to be included in the school environment? What happens when a teacher is forced to validate a student's belief that is contradictory to their own? Are students trained to validate the beliefs of their teachers despite whether they agree? What is this type of practice doing to the value of the language we use? If we are forced to validate and confirm beliefs and practices that we disagree with, then our expressed word loses value. If our expressed opinions and beliefs are validated and confirmed by others merely to put on a show of inclusion, then the value of their expressed word is demeaned as well. Everyone is pretending. What is the point in that? Where are the authentic voices we were all given upon creation? How can each person express themselves freely if they are held in account to this expectation of affirmation merely to help someone else feel included? If everyone I expressed myself to affirmed me and no one opposed my opinions, I'd question whether their affirmation was genuine. We do not need more yes men in this world. We need people willing to communicate in a respectful way despite their disagreement. In Chapter 5, Belonging Through a Culture of Dignity gets to the meat of its title, dignity. It says in Chapter 5 that the authors are using the word dignity to communicate the innate equal worth of each human being simply because that person is human. It goes on to say, every person has dignity. According to common definitions, dignity is the state or quality of being worthy to belong. This is inaccurate. I did my due diligence and explored the definition of dignity like I did the other words previously mentioned. Here's what I found. Dictionary.com defines dignity as nobility or elevation of character, worthiness. Merriam-Webster defines dignity as the quality or state of being worthy, honored, or esteemed. Cambridge Dictionary defines dignity as the importance and value that a person has that makes other people respect them or makes them respect themselves. To make sure I was getting the whole picture, I checked out a couple more dictionaries. American Heritage Dictionary defines dignity as the quality or state of being worthy of esteem or respect. The Oxford Learner's Dictionary defines dignity as a sense of your own importance and value. Let's go back to how this belonging book defined it. It said, according to common definitions, dignity is the state or quality of being worthy to belong. I just checked out 5 common definitions. Most of them placed emphasis on value and worth, but none of them used the qualifying phrase to belong. Why would the authors choose to alter the definition of the word? It is one thing to acknowledge a person's inherent value and worth, but adding to belong in the definition of dignity completely changes the entire meaning. What would happen if we inserted these collected definitions into the title of their book? Belonging Through a Culture of Being Worthy to Belong. Wow! So our teachers and other school officials are being taught that they must treat people in such a way that makes them feel belonging through a culture of being worthy to belong? What does that even mean? Do you hear how it changes the meaning? In fact, adding those 2 words not only changes the meaning of their title, it ironically demeans the actual definition of dignity. The namesake term in the title of this book about belonging isn't even being employed and applied using its real meaning. Irony is an understatement. These authors claim that people in the dominant social group, mainly whites, are devaluing others by not acknowledging their inherent value, decided to alter the meaning of dignity. They devalue the very word that they say is inherent to everyone. Here's what I know to be true. My Christian faith leads me to the Bible, which says that every person has value because each person was created in the image of God. For those of you who may not know what that means, I'll explain. The Father is the creator of all things. The Son is Jesus Christ, God in the flesh, who was born, walked the earth, died for people's sins, rose from the dead, and then ascended into heaven to sit at the right hand of God, the Father. The Holy Spirit is the invisible presence of God that lives in all those who profess Jesus to be their Savior. When God says in Genesis 1:27 that He created mankind in His own image, in the image of God He created them, He made each of us with a body, mind, and soul. We are one in 3 parts, just like Him. God created each of us, therefore we have value. There's no qualifier on the end of that. Dignity is simply having value in being worthy, not worthy to belong. In my eyes, when someone changes the definition of a word to fit their agenda, they lose all credibility. If you get anything out of this podcast episode, let it be this. Words have meaning. We cannot redefine words to be what we want them to be. We cannot alter their definitions to meet our personal agendas, and we cannot lead others astray with these unethical practices. Our society is lost. Words have lost their value because people choose to believe whatever they want despite the truth being right in front of them. Altering definitions and redefining words to mean something different than humankind has known them to be for generations only creates chaos. No one good benefits from chaos. There is so much more to explore in this book, Belonging Through a Culture of Dignity by Floyd Cobb and John Cranapple, but I'll save that for future episodes in the series called What is Belonging? Thank you for your patience in waiting for this episode to post. I'll get another episode up as soon as possible. I appreciate your support through liking, following, and sharing my podcast with others so they, too, can learn more about what's going on in the deep end of public education. That big project I mentioned at the beginning of this episode will come to fruition in a couple weeks as I've been working on a book that takes its readers on a swim in the deep end, much like we do in this podcast. But my book is meant to be more of a guide and a resource for parents who want to research their own school districts. It's called, yep, you guessed it, Deep End of Public Education, and it launches on Amazon on November 1st. Tell your neighbors and friends far and wide about it. We need people in every school district to open their eyes to the unethical and immoral practices flooding our schools and drowning our teachers, children, and families. You can check out my Deep End of Public Education Facebook page for more information as launch day approaches. Remember, launch day is November 1st on Amazon.com for Deep End of Public Education by Kristen Grubbs. Thank you again for joining me in the deep end. The water's deep and the swim is long, but let's rest our legs and catch our breath until the next dive in the deep end of public education, when we will continue exploring what belonging means in public schools. Take care and God bless.